Good morning. How are you all doing? Okay, so we're going to transition a little bit. It's very hard to follow in the footsteps of Yael Ziegler, but we'll do our best. We're going to transition from thematics to a model of reading. We're going to look at a method. So I want to begin with a question. We'll look at page 2. You can look at all the pretty pictures if you like. Top of page 2, I've got a question for you. Why do we fast on Asara B'Tevet? Anybody know? 10th of Tevet, we all fast. Anybody know why? We've been doing it a couple years now. Okay, there was a siege. Excellent. So that's a traditional understanding. In fact, there are about 3 or 4 reasons given, one of which is a siege, one of which is the death of Ezra. There's an anniversary on that. And the third, for now, top of page 2, we have the Shulchan Aruch, who provides a fascinating possibility. Look at the Shulchan Aruch, top of page 2, for those who have the sheets. B'shmona b'tevet nichtava ha-Torah yevanit b'imei Talmei ha-Melech. Thanks. On the 8th of Tevet, right around the time of the 10th of Tevet, the Torah was written into Greek by Talmei ha-Melech, which is the traditional scene which the Gemara presents, where 70 sages were split into 70 rooms, and they all translated exactly the same, despite the fact that they made alterations. So this took place, but what followed? There was a pervasive gloom. V'haya choshech ba'olam shlosha yamim. The world was saddled with darkness for 3 long days. And the question we have to ask, why is not the world's permeation with Torah's truths a celebration? Why is this a tragedy? Why is there darkness resulting from translation? So let's look at 2 options. First is the Or Gedalia, who wrote in the 19th century, and this is what he presents. Heim ratzu levatel et ha'or shebetorah. They wanted to dull the sharpness, to nullify the brightness, to end Torah's power. Ki yavan heskimu shahaya lahem beit hamikdash. Because Greece agreed that the Jews should have their temple, umedina la'atzman, and have an independent state. Aval hakol betorat culture. But everything was under the framework of culture. Meaning, they wanted to preserve the independent entity of the Israelite nation, ulavatel kedushat am Yisrael, but to undercut the notion of sanctity. They wanted to make the Torah one book in the library of civilization rather than a code and a guide for life for humanity. So that's the first possibility why this was tragic, because it was a translation entering it into the Britannica Encyclopedia rather than making it the sacred document that it is. But what we want to focus on is the Chatam Sofer in the next box. And the Or Gedalia limits this tragedy to that Greek moment, because Greece had a particular agenda, but the Chatam Sofer says this is universally tragic. Translation, paraphrase, as the title on this page says, is a crime. Why? Ra umar, it is wicked and bitter, evil, b'ha'atakat ha-Torah yivanit o l'chol lashon. The translation, the transmission out of Hebrew into any other language is wicked and bitter. Ki biyod ha-Torah k'tuva b'lashona sh'nemra m'pi HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'Moshe Rabbeinu alav ha-Shalom. Because in the Hebrew phrasing, in the words as transmitted to Moshe by God, harehi k'patish yifot set sela. The Torah is like a hammer that smashes a rock, which is actually citing from Gemara and Midrashim, which we'll get to. V'chol pasuk sovel kama perushim shonim, and every verse is laden with, laced with, multiple possibilities for interpretation. Ma she'en kein b'hatek hadorah l'shon la'az, which is not the case once it is translated into a foreign language. I evsha ki ga ki im livchor al korchach. The only option you have to choose, kvanab shuta achat, is one simple possibility. So in translation, the sparks of creative possibility are snuffed out by a translator's choice. What a text. Our verses, which are laden with purposeful ambiguities, intentional redundancies, is quashed into a monolithic script, which is tragic. And that's what is remembered on the 10th of Tevet, the tragedy of all that is lost in translation. And in fact, when Art Scroll Shas was printed, this was in theory a moment of celebration, which made the Talmud accessible to all. But if you look in Brachot in the first volume, there are more Haskamas than Dapim, first of all. There are more introductions from various rabbis that allow this. And in one from Rav Aaron Schechter, who is the Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin, he made a particular request, which Art Scroll didn't follow, but they did print it and assume no one would read, which works well enough. What did Rav Aaron Moshe Schechter say? Look in this box, fourth on the page. Tadaktakuma Ode. Be exceptionally careful when you publish this Art Scroll rendition of the Talmud. Likralo Perush. To call it not the Art Scroll translation, but the Art Scroll commentary. Why? Shazem more rak al perush hadvarim mipi hasag halomed, because this only communicates one interpretive possibility. As soon as you render a translation, you commit what we're calling, and what one scholar called, the crime of paraphrase. You end the multiplicities of interpretive creativity, the sparks of possibility are doused out. That's what happens in translation, and we're going to use this to investigate a method for reading, how Chazal, how our sages engage psukim as a patish, yafotzet sela, as a hammer that splinters a rock. And since I mentioned that, that is a verse in Yirmiyahu which is quoted 5 times in the Gemara. 3 times it's to communicate how multifarious the Torah is. How like a hammer smashes a rock, as you have a picture on your page. There are sparks thrown in every direction. That's how we should engage the text. And that's how the sages do. Every word is laden with multiple possibilities. And to exhibit this truth, the Talmud actually uses this verse in more than one way. Kapatis shefotz et sela, like a hammer that smashes a rock. Firstly, it's used to say, the Talmud chacham kasha kabarzel. A scholar has to be as hard as iron, like a hammer that smashes a rock, which is meant to indicate a strong moral backbone, hard principles, inflexibility on certain matters. That is the Talmud chacham, like a hammer that smashes a rock. Another possibility rendered by the Talmud elsewhere is that if you have impulsive desires, Yetzirah, you should go to the Bet Midrash, well known to deal with impulsive desires. And it suggests the Torah is Kapatish Yefotz Sel. It's a hammer that smashes a rock. It is a triumphant force that battles destructive impulses. So that verse is used in that way. And now to complete the introduction to the method, I want to look at one scene in the Talmud. And in this scene we have a Talmudic sage studying in a rather unusual way. Look under the hammer. The Gemara in Shabbat. Rava dekama ein b'shmaita. Rava was investigating study. He was learning. V'yatfa atzbata didei tutei kara, and he was sitting with his fingers under his feet. I challenge any of you to get into that posture. I have no idea how he was doing that, but he was athletic. So he was sitting with fingers under his feet. V'kamaitzbahu, and he was rubbing his feet while he was studying. V'kamavan atzbe dama, and his fingers began to bleed. And the Gemara moves on to describe what the situation was. It's a conflict with the Sadducee. Anyone know why they were called Sadducees, by the way? Because they were sad, you see. Yeah, that got me through high school. Okay. Either way. So the Talmud presents this scene when Rav is sitting with fingers bleeding, rubbing his foot. And Emmanuel Levinas in the next box, some of you may have come across, with a French phenomenological philosopher, trying to make it as impossible to say as possible. He wrote a number of books. He was a secular philosopher, and if he was asked, are you a Jewish philosopher, he would say, no, I'm a philosopher. And he wrote a book called Totality and Infinity, which is totally and infinitely impossible to read. That said, he wrote a number of books on Talmudic readings. He was very involved with Jewish education, adult education in France, and he wrote a book called Beyond the Verse, one called In the Time of the Nations, one called Difficult Freedom, and one called Talmudic Readings. Some were written by him and some were written by students. Talmudic Readings is what we're going to see, and he comments on this scene. He doesn't leave it arbitrary, random, or neglected. He says every moment in the Talmudic passage is relevant, and this is how he describes Rava bleeding fingers rubbing his feet. The sight is not edifying enough. That's his French emphasis. Very nice. One might have expected to see Rabba meditating dreamily while caressing his beard or rubbing his hands. Rabba's gesture is odd. He rubs his foot so hard that blood spurts out. As if by chance to rub in such a way that blood spurts out is perhaps the way one must rub the text to arrive at the life it conceals. This is how, according to Levinas, we must engage our text. This is how we must treat Tanakh. We must rub and scour, massage and hammer every text to wring out every imaginable latent possibility for its meaning. So that's the introduction said. Let's turn the page and look at a few examples in the time that we have. I have 3 possible examples. We'll see how far we get. And then I'll wrap up with a conclusion. Now you know the structure. First example, page 3. And we're going to go through some narrative from Shemot. Moshe was raised in the palace, a prince of Egypt, given every luxury he needed. And then his first steps he walks into the real world. And what is the first sight that he sees? What does Moshe first see when he leaves the palace? Egyptian striking a Jew. And at that moment, with that vision, with that sight, he has a choice to make. And look at the pasuk we're given, top of page 3. V'yifenecho v'cho, and he looked here and there. V'yarki ein ish, and he saw there was no man. V'yach et hamitzri, he struck the Egyptian. V'yitmenehu b'chol, and he hid him in the sand. Now if we were to commit the crime of paraphrase and just paraphrase that verse, it means Moshe went out, he looked around, no one was there, he hit the Egyptian and he buried him. Okay? But if we engage this pasuk as we're instructed by the sages and hammer away, scour away at the latent possibilities, we'll notice that there are issues with this verse. There are redundancies, there is excess, and there is ambiguity. Firstly, v'yifenecho v'cho seems to be excessive. We don't need that. If I was, again, this is not claiming to be God, but if I were trying to be God, and I was thinking, how can I capture the perfect sentence to be as minimal and expansive as possible, to include everything in the smallest amount of space, I would just say, v'yarki ein ish, he saw there was no man, and he struck the Egyptian. Why do we need to say he's looking here and there? And within that, cho v'cho is repetitive. That's the first point. V'yarki ein ish, and he saw there was no man, is ambiguous. What does it mean? He saw there was no man. The inference is there was something else. That seems to be how the sages read. And at the very end, do I really care if he hid the Egyptian in sand or dirt behind a wall, round a corner, in a river? What do I care where he hid the Egyptian? V'yitmenehu, and he hid him. But chol is added, and again, if we've got divine intention constructing these verses, why add that extra word? So we're now going to split open like a hammer smashing a rock, look at various possibilities in this verse. So the first one is Rashi, and we're going to see through these multiple possibilities very different constructions of Moshe's character, of this moment, the decision he had to make, and how important this is for the rest of the narrative. Firstly, in Rashi, v'yifenecho v'cho, he looked this way and that. Kipshuto kamashma, oh, stop going crazy, it makes sense on the surface. That's Rashi's first interpretation. How would you read that? I'm now asking you as an audience. V'yifenecho v'cho, Moshe's looking this way and that way. What is he doing? What emotion is permeating his being at that time? He's afraid. He's afraid, fear, guilty. Okay, so we've got fear. I'd say he's nervous, he's timid, he's hesitant. And in fact, if you look at the image here, which is, I think, Gustave Doré, who is an Italian Bible illustrator, that's exactly what Moshe looks like. He's got this sword hidden. He's looking around, making sure no one can spy him. He is tentative, timid, hesitant, and nervous. That's the pshat. And he's looking in the wrong direction. And he's looking in the wrong direction.
If you look at this illustration,
yeah.
Besides the guy he's killing, there are two people in the scene.
Yeah.
And Moshe's not looking at
him. So what do you make of that? What did you make of that?
Rashi probably doesn't mean we should look at much more in relation to this illustration.
What do you think?
That it can't be Moshe. Because it's so obvious that it's not.
Oh, okay. But he's saying on the surface there, you read this verse, that's the first impression you get. Moses is this nervous person who, as you say, is so desperate to look over his shoulder to make sure no one's watching that the image captures him looking the wrong way. Okay. But Rashi says that's not enough. As you say, cho v'cho is not excessive, it's not poetic extrapolation to determine an emotion, but it means something in particular. V'yifen cho v'cho, second box on the page, ra'a ma'asalo b'bayit, he saw what this man did in the house, u'ma'asalo b'sadeh, and what he did in the field. Cho v'cho is not just excessive poetry or repetitive, it is demonstrated. He looked here and there, two distinct spaces. He looked in the house, which according to tradition, he had just abused the wife of this man. He then goes out to the field and he starts killing the man because he came in and found him abusing his wife. So he sees the depravity in the house, the brutality in the field. This isn't a moment of timidity or hesitance. This is a moment of moral outrage. He's seen depravity and brutality. He's seen a comprehensive purview of this fellow's vice. This is a moment of moral outrage, not timidity. So as you say, that picture captures only one layer through one lens of this verse, but if we smash further, we have more to say. So what happens next? Look at the next part of the verse. V'yarki ein ish, he saw there was no man. Paraphrase, what does that mean? No one was there. Okay, so now we've got the nervous Moses is calmed, no one's here, that's fine. But actually there are four other possibilities. There was no man, but what was there? Look at the Malbim. V'yarkiein ish aval malachim ra'av nimlach aleihem. Oh, but there was angels there. So what was Moshe looking for? He looked to angels and got counsel. So this is Moses, not nervous, but confused. This is the first time in life he's challenged with a moral decision. He sees what he clearly objects to. And he needs guidance, he needs counsel, he needs advice, and he looks around. He's looking around, not because he's nervous, because he needs a moral leadership. He needs someone to spur him forward, and he finds angels. For Yarki Einish, he has celestial counsel. That's according to the Malbim. Again, a very different image to a nervous Moses, or just an outraged Moses. This is now complicated by him needing counsel. Look at Rashi, Yarki Einish, and this is a misprint, I apologize. What did Moshe say? He said, there was no man. What is the subject, Rashi says? Atid lat seit mimenu, that's not Manoach, who's Shmuel's father, this is mimenu, the chet is note 8 in the Torah Tamima. Atid lat seit mimenu shiitka'er. Moshe saw there was no man. Where was there no man? Coming from the progeny of this Egyptian. This was a prophetic vision where he saw this fellow has no redeeming future. He will have no children who will be worth saving. This is a prophetic vision which justifies capital punishment. It doesn't matter who's around. He is oblivious to the surroundings. Moshe is purely looking through a moral and prophetic lens. Einish, there is no redeeming factor to this person. Snuff him out. So that's the second layer. Third layer, looking for Yikra Rabbah, and this is the one that appeals to me perhaps most, and maybe to you as well. This is for Yikra Rabbah, this is the Midrash. V'yarki Einish, he saw there was no man. What does that mean? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ra'ah she'ein mi she'yamod v'yikaneh l'shmo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Moshe leaves the palace, who has been an insulated prince. He sees vice and violence on the streets of Egypt, for Yarki ain ish, and he sees there is no man. There's no moral conscience. There's no arbiter of justice. There's no man who's standing up to this. So he's not looking around to guard his back. He's not looking around for counsel. He's looking around and he is shocked that ain ish, there's no one standing up for justice. And in fact, this resonates through Pirkei Avot. Anybody knows which quote I'm thinking of in Pirkei Avot? I think that's it. I couldn't quite hear, but I think you got it. B'makom she'ein ish, in a place where there is no person, hishtadel liot ish, be that person. And I have the feeling that that resonates through this verse, v'yakiyin ish, he saw there was no man, so Moshe stood up. This was a time where his moral spine grew into being. Okay? And then we have the final rendering in the Malbim, V'yarki ein ish, this is the second one in the Malbim. He saw there was no man. Where was he looking? Was he looking on the streets? Was he looking into the future through prophetic vision? Was he looking to just forces? According to this Malbim, he was looking inside. He looked cho v'cho here and there. He looked inside, V'yarki ein ish, and he saw he was no man. Shira'ah et atzmo ki eino ish. He saw he wasn't purely human. Rak mitzuraf el malachim. He had some sort of melding or merging with the angels. V'hiko b'kocha ruchani shabo, and he struck the Egyptian with a spiritual force. I'm not sure what to make of this. It could be he looked here and there. He was looking for a weapon. He couldn't find anything. And he figured out he was angelic, so he used spiritual force to attack. But this is certainly a moment of self-identity. And I've heard other people render that he's born an Egyptian. He suddenly discovers his Jewish roots, and he looks to the Jewish side, to the Egyptian side, and he sees that's not a person. That is schizophrenic. That is not an identity. So what did he do? He struck the Egyptian in him. And that's when he became fully Jewish and embraced his identity. I've heard that rendering too. So what we see is, if we hammer through this verse, it is not a simple scene where Moshe is timid and hesitant, looking around at what should I do? Should I hit this person? But actually, potentially, a moment of moral outrage, a moment of conscience coming into being, a moment of spiritual awakening. And as we dig deeper and deeper, scouring through the words again and again, like Rava, until our fingers bleed from the biblical friction. That's the title. Very good. I got that in. I'm glad. Through the biblical friction here, we rub through until we get to more meaning. Now let's just finish this verse and we'll move on to the next example. He was buried in sand. And we said that was redundant. That was excessive and unnecessary. Why do I care what he was buried in? Okay, buried him in sand. I don't care. Was there a box? Was there a coffin? Was there a bag? Was there a spade? Where's the spade? If you're giving me the details, you haven't done full justice. So what's going on? V'itmeneu b'chol yichizkuni adds shahaya sham letzorach habinyan. Why is that necessary to note? The Chizkuni says he used the sand that was being used for building, for construction. Okay, another detail. Do I need to know what was the construction company's name? But what he might be hinting at here is that there is a poetic justice here. The material that fueled the brutality of servitude that was used over the Egyptians to force them into slavery is exactly what is buried for the Egyptian is buried in. This is poetic justice, where he's buried beneath the material that has fueled his brutality. And that completes the picture in a very profound way. He buried him in that sand. This is poetic justice. Again, not timid Moshe trying to throw him beneath the sand, but saying, this is where you belong. Beneath the fuel of your own brutality. We have a question.
Are you using poetic justice the way we would also see Nida claiming?
Yeah, potentially. Yeah. That he deserves this. He was using that to bury them, and now he's being buried in it. You could say that. Absolutely. The Ramban moves back in a different direction, and he says, V'itmeneu b'chol, he was hidden in sand, is not just excess. Neither is it a way of poetic justice, but it's metaphor. Look at him, V'itmeneu b'chol, ha'chol hazeh, this sand, adam notlo mikan v'notnu b'kan. You can move sand around from here and there, v'ena kol yotzeh, and it moves silently. This isn't pebbles or rocks or stones or a wall. This is a material so granular that you can barely hear it. It moves in silence and in stealth. Kach lo yishma ha-davar, so this thing was not heard. V'itmeneu b'chol doesn't mean he literally buried them in sand. Nachmanides Ramban agrees that's excessive, redundant, and unnecessary information. V'itmeneu b'chol means, and he enveloped it in stealth, in secrecy. This was clandestine. So again, we have an excessive word. Through biblical friction, we scour it until we find meaning, either metaphoric or poetic justice. Okay, so that's example number one. Let's turn the page, and you can zone in and out the different examples so we can move through. Okay, next scene, in Moshe's life as well. Moshe had disappeared, he went off to Midian. He then returns under the coercion of God. God says, this is your job, you have to go. And Moshe says, I can't speak. In one of the most poetic verses we see, I haven't spoken, I can't speak. All my life I've been unable to speak. I don't even manage the poetic justification that Moshe gives. And then he gets to Egypt. He confronts Pharaoh, and what happens after that first confrontation? It gets worse. And you can imagine that moment. The outrage in Moshe. You compelled me. You forced, I said I was not right for this. I said I shouldn't be doing this. You brought me here, and the burden has doubled. They're making bricks without straw. And this is what he says to God. Top of the page, V'yashav Moshe l'Adonai, Moshe said to God, I've just seen that we've got the name there, so I apologize, you can't throw this out. V'yomar, and he said to God, Adonai, my God, lama hare'ota la'am hazeh, why do you commit evil against this people? A powerful indictment. Lama zeh shelachtani, why have you even sent me? And that's how that parasha finishes. End of Shmos. A powerful, formidable indictment against God. How could you commit evil against this people? And then what does God say? The opening of Parashat Bo. No, it's not Bo, is it? Maybe it's Bo, who knows? Va'era. Va'era, thank you. Parsha Va'era, and what does he say? Va'idaber Elohim el Moshe, God says to Moses, V'yomalav, and he said to him, Ani Adonai, I'm God. So what do you make of that? If we again commit the crime of paraphrase, what does that verse mean? God's responding to Moshe's indictment, what does he say? I'm God. What? Calm yourself down. I'm God. I will do it the way I want. Don't be so rude. That's what that looks like, right? And if we look at Rashi, he actually uses the grammatical structure to justify that reading. Vaydaber lehim el Moshe. It's not vayomer, it's vaydaber. Daber ito mishpat. This is in the mode of justice. He speaks to Moshe harshly. He rebukes the indictment. Al shakshel daber v'lamar l'maharot l'mazer. Because he said to God, how could you do this evil? He responds and says, how dare you? And what is his finish? Vayom elav ani Hashem ne'eman l'shalem schatov l'midhalchim l'fanai. Trust me, I'm God, it'll work out. That's how Rashi reads this verse, and that's almost essentially how we paraphrased it. God's response to the indictment is, chill out. And more than that, he says, how dare you? I'm God, we'll figure it out. We have a question.
Is it important that the word Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei is used instead of the other names of God? Doesn't Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei supposed to be mercy. So isn't that supposed to tell us something just by the word that's used to describe?
Interesting, and I would say excellent question, and that's precisely the avenue we're going down. You've got your hammer in hand, and that's what we're doing. We're smashing through this verse. There are three problems with this verse. We've got one, but it's more than just that that name is used. There's a nominal shift. The verse begins Vayad Elohim, and then it moves into Hashem. Okay, that's a nominal shift. We also have a verbal alteration. What shifts? It begins Vayadaber, and it goes into Vayomer. And there's a redundancy. Anyone find the word that's really unnecessary in this verse? Excellent. Oh, it's straightforward. I didn't need to tell you even. Elav. There are three problems. Again, if I'm God constructing the perfect verse, punctuated, grammatized, syntactically perfect, what a mess. Right? This verse has got redundancy, it's got nominal shift, it's got verbal alteration. What's going on? Vaydaber Vayomer Elohim Adonai. Elav. What is going on? And it is the Kli Yakar who, for me, exhibited the power of this verse. That the crime that we committed in saying this is God saying to Moshe, chill out, I'm in charge, renders this verse a moment of profound emotional tenderness. And we're going to see that. Look in the Kli Yakar. Elav miyutar legamre. The word elav is completely extra. It doesn't. It just said, El Moshe, he spoke to Moshe, Vayoma Elav, and he said to him, what a waste of a word. That's what the Kli Yakar says. Kikfar hiskish moshel Moshe. Vinira lefaresh, which is helpful because that would have been a terrible question to leave with, he's going to answer. Shalakach nikra Moshe velo Mashui. It's not Mashui Rabbeinu, unless you go to a particular community. It's Moshe Rabbeinu, not Mashui. And what's the difference? Why do I say that? Mashui is in the past tense. Moshe is present, because Moshe is in the present tense. Why is that relevant? Because Moshe's name, according to Kli Yakar, is not an arbitrary choice based on a past event. He's not called Moshe. If someone asks you, why was Moshe called Moshe? Kli Yakar is saying it's not because he was drawn out of the water. That was coincidence or even symbolic, but it's not because of that event. Ela, Lashon Moshe u'Moshech. It is a terminology of extraction and withdrawal. Moshe, to pull out. Ki hu ha-moshech et Yisrael min ha-galut. Because he extracted, he was to extract Israel from exile min ha-mayim ha-zedonim, from vile waters. So Moshe, he's saying, is an important name. It's not just the nominal address to Moses, but it has significance. He has the power to extract Israel from exile. And if Moshe would have taken the moment to examine his name, according to the Kli Yakar, he would know truly and surely that he would be the force that liberates and redeems Israel. And he wouldn't accuse God to say, why have you sent me, lama ra'uta, why have you done evil? According to the Kli Yakar, this verse is God saying, Vaydaber Elohim el Moshe, and God spoke to Moshe, saying, Moshe, take a second to think about your name, your destiny, your promise, your potential. You are the extracting force, the redeemer of Israel. Lekach ne'emar, and then he spells it out. Vaydaber dibu kasher. This verse begins, as we've said, harsh, justice, accusation. Elohim zemidat hadin, and that's why that word is used at the beginning. God is saying, Moshe, look at your name. Ye of little faith, so to speak. El Moshe, and why El Moshe? Lomar shehu ra'ui litenet hadin al shelo badak bishmo Moshe. And Moshe deserves this justice. That's why it says El Moshe, because that's what God was talking to. He was talking to Moshe's power, his potential, his destiny. Ulahavin mitocho shehu ye Moshe, Moshe chid Yisrael men ha-galut, and Moshe should have understood this. And we can imagine the scene when God is responding to the rebuke, to the indictment, and says to Moshe, how dare you? Look at your name. You have such a destiny, such power, such force in you. How can you say this? And you can see Moshe melting before God, feeling like a nothing. And I find it useful to transplant this either into a parental or a pedagogic situation for parents or children addressing a child who comes and says, I can't do it. What do you mean you can't do it? I know what you're capable of. I've seen your potential and your power. How can you come to me like that? And you can see the kid beginning to cry under the weight of that rebuke. And then what happens? Look, end of the Kli Yakar. So powerful. Ach Nitmaleh Hashem alav rachamim. And halfway through this verse, God suddenly is overcome by compassion. He sees this man who he has been rebuking, and he sees him crumble. Vayomer amira racha. So we have a shift from vaydaber into a soft, a tender, a gentle approach. He says gently, a love, and he speaks, a love is not excessive. It is accessible. It is the moment when he speaks a love to him, who he is right now. Not to Moshe, his potential, his destiny, his power, but to the man right in front of him, Bishvil Mahot Atzmo. He spoke to this man's essence. Ki ma'achar shahaya kaped la'peh v'lashon, because it was the heaviness of tongue and mouth. Al kein mal'u libo lomar lama zeh shelachtani, because he realized Moshe didn't doubt God. He doubted himself. It was suddenly he is overcome by his spoken inability, by the heaviness of tongue, and he feels incapable. And that's why he says, why have you sent me? It is not because he does not trust God. It's because he's lost faith in himself. Uvishvil elav neumalo ani Hashem. And that's why we shift to the Yudke Vavke, which is Hamore al Rachamim, a moment of compassion. Kishmo umahoto sitre adadi, because Moshe's name and his essence at that point conflict. Moshe could not trace the path from his present state to his inevitable destiny. And this is a profound moment of emotional shift. In what we thought was a run-of-the-mill, regular verse, and God said to Moshe, I'm God, chill out, get over it, is actually a profound moment. Once we hammer through those words of emotional shift, of compassion, of understanding, of encouragement, when he moves from that harsh judge into that compassionate father, from Malkeinu to Avinu. Okay. So that was example number two. Let's turn the page. And I want to shift gears very briefly before we sum up, and then I can let you all go home and avoid the snowstorm that's currently percolating outside. So far we've seen that biblical narrative, the stories are laden with purposeful ambiguities, redundancies, excesses, shifts, alterations, gaps, so that we jump in, hammer through, and find multiple possibilities that enrich the text and enrich us as people. But what we'll find is, and I wanted to give an example, in the legal and legislative context, because I don't want you to think this is just imaginative creation in narrative, but actually legally, this is how the rabbis work. You find one verse, you hammer through into multiple legal possibilities. I wanted to give one example, and it's from Parshat Kedoshim, top of page 5. Uvashana hachamishit tochlu et peryon. In the 5th year you'd eat its fruit. La'osif lachem tvorato ani Hashem Elokeichem. In the 5th year you shall eat your produce. And what is this referring to? Which law? Anybody know?
Orla.
When you plant a tree, the first 3 years you can't touch it. The 4th year you have to take it to the mikdash. 5th year you can eat your fruit. Okay, that's one verse. And then in stream of consciousness style, the Torah moves to a new law. V'lo tochlu al hadam. You should not eat on blood. You shouldn't do divination. I'm in divinity school, so I'm breaching this. I apologize. No divination. And no soothsaying. Okay? What does it mean, lo tochlu al hadam? Do not eat on blood. Anybody able to guess just from what does that mean? From context? Meaning, if there's blood on the floor, I shouldn't have my breakfast over it? What does this mean? But we see here complete ambiguity. And the sages are going to dive in. But before we do that, let's look at some medieval commentaries who are trying to get just to the pshat, just to understand it. Because what the problem we have here, I've written here, is syntactical ambiguity and semantic uncertainty, which I was sure would be completely meaningless to me and anyone listening. But syntactical ambiguity means, where does this part of the verse attach to? Lo tochlu al hadam, what is its context? Does it speak to the divination part? Is it speaking to the orla that just came? Is it completely independent? And I was going to note here that actually, commas have been known to save lives. Anybody know this? The commas can save a life. I'll give you an example. If you write a sentence, let's eat, comma, grandma, that's very different without a comma. Good. I'm glad some people haven't heard that. My grandma's fine, if any of you want to know. There's no problem. But context and syntax is central. That's not, no one's really in danger right now. But that's very important for context. That's very different meaning. Second is, I've noted semantic ambiguity, and semantic means meaning. What does it mean, lo tachlu al hadam? I literally shouldn't have breakfast over a pool of blood. What does it mean? So the Rashbam, first of all, says, the fibshuto davar lamed b'inyano. He says, and we're going to see, the Talmud has six possibilities, and they all are halach lamaisa. But firstly, the Rashbam says, let's ignore that for the moment and just figure out what it actually means from the context. Lo tinachashuv lo ta'anunu. It's in the same verse that says, don't do divination or soothsaying. So what does it mean? There was a practice among the nations of the world, or some segments of the nations of the world, when somebody was killed, you would eat by their graveside with some sort of enchantment to stop the soul taking vengeance on you or the killer. Okay? Strange thing, but we're being told not to do that. Like we say, and I had to look that phrase up a number of times, no idea what that meant. Mismar milat saluv, anyone know? Mismar is a nail. Sorry? A cross, you got it. I had no idea what that was. But, and this is superstition. You carry around the nails on the cross, you eat by the graveside, some sort of enchantment to try and stop things going on. So that's what we... Lo tachlu al hadam means don't do these superstitions. So he paraphrases that, nothing to do with blood in particular, but just avoid these superstitious activities. Ibn Ezra has a very different reading, and again, he puts the comma in a different place. He says this, lo tachlu al hadam, has nothing to do with that verse, but the verse prior, which was about orla. How do you link that? This is what he says. Dabur gemakatuv lamala, it's relevant to the previous verse. Ki hizir al eitz natush lo yochlam miperyad shna chamishit, where we're told and commanded and injuncted not to eat until the fifth year. We have to have impatience in our consumption. Sorry? Patience in our consumption. Gam kein kol basar tahor, so too, any meat which you can eat, we're being told, lo yachlu ad sheyizrok dam al mizbech Hashem, you shouldn't eat until the blood has been sprinkled on the mizbech. Lo tochlu al adam means you should not start eating korbanot before they've sprinkled the blood. So it's thematically linked in terms of consumptional patience. You've got to wait to eat fruit, you've got to wait to eat flesh. Those are the two possibilities. Let's skip down now under that beautiful picture of breakfast, which makes me hungry, to look at the sages. The sages say, some of which encompass what we've seen, but they give six possibilities. Number one, Tanya, minayin la'ochel min ha'behema, how do we know that if you eat from an animal, kodem shetetz inafsha, before its soul has left, which means until the main blood has left, it's probably dead at this point, but the blood is still leaving, but you shouldn't eat. Shehu b'lo tase, how do you know that's forbidden? Talmud lo melo tochlo al adam, you shouldn't eat on the blood. And they say, oh, this means you shouldn't eat while there's blood here. Which doesn't literally mean a pool of blood on the floor, but al does mean on the blood. Okay, so that's one possibility. Dava acha, lo tochlu al adam, lo tochlu basa v'adav dam b'mizrak. And that's what the Ibn Ezra said. You shouldn't eat before the blood has been sprinkled. So both of those things, al hadam means on the blood is in the bowl, it's in the animal, you shouldn't be eating at this point. And now we shift gears to different readings. Rabbi Dosa, Rabbi Dosa is minayin she'ein mavrin al haruge beit din. How do we know that you're not mavrin for haruge beit din? Anyone know what mavrin is?
Escort.
It's similar. Of in avelut, some may have done avelut. There is a sudat havra, right? The first meal after someone's been buried is called the sudat havra. Halachically, one is not allowed to eat their own food. If they're an avel, someone has to bring them food. And there are two reasons given. I'll note quickly. One is because we're worried that the mourner won't eat, will be so bereaved, they're not going to eat. So we have a halachic structure which forces you to eat because someone has to bring you food. The other possibility given by some of the commentators is that actually you're going to be so bereaved, you're going to be undignified and just get lost in your food. Kind of, what do they call it? Nervous eating? I don't know, there's something. Stress eating? I don't know what it is. People eat ice cream on the couch. What is that called? Anyone know? That is enjoyable. There's some phrase I'm forgetting. Okay, either way. Guilt eating? I don't know, I've forgotten it. Anyway, I'm not going to do it. Not having ice cream is bad for me. Okay, either way, we're being told that Mavrin, this Suda, which traditionally the mourner has, is not done for someone who is put to death capital punishment by the Bet Din. Why? Talmud Loma, lo tochlu al adam. You shouldn't eat on the blood. Meaning someone who's been put to death by the Bet Din is blood or guilty, and you shouldn't be eating because of that. So al does not mean on, but it means because of, in this sense. Okay, so we've got that ambiguity with al. Let's look at Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva Omer, minayin Sanhedrin shaharu ala nefesh, shein tomin klum al alto ayom. How do we know that if the Sanhedrin, there is a court, capital punishment puts someone to death, they shouldn't eat all that day. They should not be consuming a thing. How do we know? Talmud Loma, lo totlo al hadam, you should not eat on the blood. And in this case, al does mean on. Meaning the Bet Din is about to put someone to death, and they're going to have a lavish bagel breakfast. This is tasteless and insensitive eating. Eating as mourners on someone who's been put to death for committing murder or infraction of some other biblical injunction. And the court that's about to put someone to death also shouldn't be eating, because this person to some degree shouldn't be being grieved in the usual way. And you should be sensitive because there is a loss here. And it's quite profound. I don't know if there are any rules on the American books that the judges who have committed someone to murder shouldn't be eating. I have no idea. But there's a claim here that this is insensitive and tasteless. We should not be eating lo tochlu al adam, which comes in the context of orla and witchcraft. We're being told, oh, this is talking about the Sanhedrin. They shouldn't be eating when someone's being put to death. Completely ripped from context, hammered through those three, four words. And then we have two more. Rabbi Yochanan Omer, Azhara leben sora omor minaya. Legally speaking, in order to execute a punishment, you need to have what's called an azhara, a warning in the text, and the verse itself. It's not enough to say Ben Seremori needs to be put to death. You need a separate azhara. That's a legal concept we can get to another time. And we're saying this is azhara l'sora ben seremori. And al in this context does not mean on or because of, it means toward. You should not be eating al hadam toward your inevitable self-ruin. So this is the warning to the ben sora amora that you shouldn't be, because how do you become ben sora amora? Eat meat, drink wine, steal money, have parents who look completely identical and sound exactly the same, enough to drive you crazy to steal their money and eat meat. Either way, this is a warning. So what again is talking about orla, or witchcraft, is being told that the Bet Din can't eat before capital punishment, the family shouldn't grieve. This is a warning to Ben Sora Amor, you shouldn't eat meat while the animal's still fidgeting on the floor, which is sensible enough for me. And you shouldn't be eating while the bowl is still full of blood. And then the final one, which some of you may not like because of cake on Shabbos morning, but this is the source, biblical source, in Brachot. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, he says, "Ma'idistiv lo tochlu al adam." What does it mean, don't eat on the blood, in the context of orla and witchcraft? What does it mean? Lo tochlu kodim shetitpalelu al damchem. Do not eat before you've prayed for your blood. So from that contract, from that context, we manage to extract meaning about daily ritual, that we shouldn't be eating breakfast before we do tefillah. And this is the biblical source quoted by all the halakhic authorities about eating breakfast before davening. If you want to eat breakfast before davening, ask your local Orthodox rabbi. Do not go just based on what I said. There are exceptions. Everyone agrees you can have water. Some people say you can even have tea if it's very important to you culturally. We'll talk about that another time. So what we've seen here is that same verse, lo tochlu al adam, can be encouraging and embracing a whole array of virtues. We've seen patience, justice, sensitivity, prescience and priority, and it goes for multiple realms. It goes through sacrificial ritual, prayer, court of law, house of mourning, and the adolescent mind. The same verse is being hammered, scoured, rubbed, twisted to mean multiple things. And that's how the sages read. And the theme for today is Tanakh, so I thought I'd do, instead of one theme, we'd do a method of how the sages read Tanakh, which we can all employ ourselves. Let's turn the page. In the final few minutes, I want to finish with what I've called one final friction, just so that I keep justifying the title that I chose. So let's read Jeffrey Hartman. He was a professor at Yale who did originally comparative literature and then came across into Jewish studies, Midrash. And this has happened all over the country in very prominent universities, University of Chicago among them. I've been told and paid to say that. But this has happened. A lot of literary professors have suddenly moved into Midrash, particularly Jewish professors, because of precisely what we've seen. It was often Midrash was cast as these crazy imaginings of, you know, drunk rabbis saying, oh, this happened and that happened, and everyone's like, they're crazy. But if you look closely at the text, everything is what James Kugel called an exegetical occasion. Every Midrash is triggered by something in the text, an ambiguity, a redundancy, an excess. Everything stems from the text. So all these literary professors have moved to Midrash to see what a wonderful literary endeavor this is. So let's look at Jeffrey Hartman. The Bible can be distinguished from fiction by its frictionality. That's where I got the title. Its capacity to leave traces which incite and even demand interpretation of what it is, has incorporated. Bible stories do not give us something artfully rendered, meaning they do not give us the complete and final picture. They force readers to become interpreters and find the presence of what is absent in the fraught background, the densely layered narrative. I just wanted to put that there so you know where I got the title from, and you can read his book if you like. But it's also true, as we've seen, not just for narrative, biblical narrative, but also biblical law. We have this ambiguity which triggers tons of possibilities. Kapatish, yafot, setzela, like a hammer that sparks in 1,000 directions. So I want to finish with one final friction and then we'll wrap up. Bottom of the page, and this is something I've read a couple of times in a couple of shirim, so you may have heard it. If you've been to a shir, I apologize. But for me, it's worth repeating. And I'm going to ask you about this verse. There are a litany of curses in the book of Dvarim. And one of them appears as follows. Bottom box on page 6. V'hayitim amashesh b'tzoharayim, if you disobey me, if you ignore and neglect my teaching, Israel, you will grope b'tzoharayim at midday, ka'asheh yamashesh ha'aver ba'afelah, like the blind grope in the darkness. Let me ask you a question. What is redundant in this verse? Right. There is a redundancy. You should just say, you will grow b'tzoharayim kashe yimashesh ha'iver, like the blind do. Ha'iver ba'afela, the blind in the dark, they grow more in the dark, they can't tell the difference. Right? That is, again, poetically powerful, but if I'm God, and again, every letter, every syntax, every phoneme is central and important, why add an extra word? So let's look at the box. I'm Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi said, Kol yamai hayiti mitzta'er al pasuk zeh. My whole life, I was pained, distressed. I was agonizing over this verse, which again, models the way we should approach Tanakh. If we see an ambiguity, it shouldn't be, okay, write that off, biblical critic, this is a messy text. But it should mitzta'er al pasuk zeh. We should agonize over what the possibilities glimmering underneath it are. Uma ichbat le la iver ben afela alora. And Rabbi Yossi asks exactly our question: what difference does it make to the blind whether it's night or day? There is an extra word here. Ad, until. Shapam achat halachti beishon laila vaafela. Once Rabbi Yossi says, I was walking along the streets. It was dark as night. It was night. It was dark, and it was night. V'ra'iti suma mahalech v'avuka b'yado, and I was walking along, and I saw a blind man walking with a torch in his hand, meaning a fire, like we've got a picture of here. Amarti lo, and I said, Bini, avuka zulamale. He says, my son, I know you're blind, I know you're the blind man. Why do you have a torch? That can't be helping you. It looks ridiculous. Amar lo, Amar li, and he said to me, Rabbi Yossi says, the blind man said to me, Kolzman shavuka biyadi, bnei adam ro'in oti, umatzilin oti, minapachatim umanakotzim ibernakim. You're right, it doesn't help me. But when I hold the torch, others can see me. They see I'm blind, and they offer me assistance. So the threat, the curse is now doubled. And it's not an extra word that makes no difference. The pain, the agony is resolved through a little scouring, not just of the text, but of real life. What was God saying? If you disobey me, you will grope at midday like the blind in the dark. And that's not just a redundant one, but the blind in the dark are not just blind alone, but it is loneliness itself. You are unaided, neglected, unassisted, and alone. You're blind and unseen. That is the threat. By the way, Mr. Erel Pasuk Zer appears 4 times in Tanakh, and another time we could do a talk about painful psukim and look at the 4 psukim that agonized the sages. But in the meantime, I want to finish with that example and summarize. We've seen, firstly, an introduction where we saw why we fast on Asara B'Tevet. Remember that fact for next year, because there's nothing ever to say about Asara B'Tevet. Okay, there was a siege, that's all we know. Actually, Ezra died, and what's lost in translation? The crime of paraphrase is what Asara B'Tevet remembers. We then looked at Rava, whose fingers bled while he rubbed his feet, because that's how, according to Levinas, we must approach the text, through scouring, massaging, hammering, wringing every imaginable latent possibility. We then saw the example of Moshe, who has that first scene. He looked this way and that way, which might mean he is timid, hesitant, or it might mean he's seen a perspective of depravity and brutality. We then saw there was no man. What did that mean? We then said he hit him in sand. Why did he do that? You can look at the sheets if you like. We then saw example number 2, when Moshe indicts God for evil and God responds, and if we paraphrase, it sounds like he just dismisses him. But actually, with a little bit of hammering, we found out it was a profound moment of tenderness and emotional compassion. We then saw the third example, which was a legal context, where lo tochlu al adam might mean you can't have breakfast before shacharis, or it might mean you can't eat before you kill someone, or capital punishment, you put them to death. And then we finish with a final friction, a quote from Jeffrey Hartman, and a final friction which pained and agonized the sages and modeled the way we should approach the text in order that it comes to life and that it enriches our lives. I'll leave it there, and I wish you a good Sunday, and enjoy the snow. I don't know what to do with this machine. Hello, how are you? Booked, yeah. Do you have to stop?